In John chapter 4, Jesus describes the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. Verses 23 and 24. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth. Now for the next few minutes, stay tuned to Worship in Spirit and Truth with Pastor Jeff Scoggins.
Father Heaven, once again, we invite your Spirit to guide us, especially as we get into this pivotal point in Revelation. We want to follow you no matter what, no matter where you're going, even when you lead into uncomfortable territory. Help us to see clearly the rightness, the truth of what is in this critical section of Revelation. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Okay. Open your Bibles to Revelation 14, and let's listen to it.
Revelation 14. Then I looked, and there before me was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a sound from heaven like the roar of rushing waters and like a loud peal of thunder. The sound I heard was like that of harpists playing their harps. And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. No one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. These are those who did not defile themselves with women, but they kept themselves pure. They follow the Lamb wherever he goes. They were purchased from among men and offered as first fruits to God and the Lamb. No lie was found in their mouths. They are blameless. Then I saw another angel flying in midair. And he had the eternal gospel to proclaim to those who live on the earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. He said in a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and the springs of water." A second angel followed and said, "Fallen! Fallen is Babylon the Great, which made all the nations drink the maddening wine of her adulteries." A third angel followed them and said in a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast in his image and receives his mark on the forehead or on the hand, he too will drink of the wine of God's fury, which has been poured full strength into the cup of his wrath. He will be tormented with burning sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment rises forever and ever. There is no rest day or night for those who worship the beast in his image or for anyone who receives the mark of his name." This calls for patient endurance on the part of the saints who obey God's commandments and remain faithful to Jesus. Then I heard a voice from heaven say, "Write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on." "Yes," says the Spirit, "they will rest from their labor, for their deeds will follow them." I looked, and there before me was a white cloud. And seated on the cloud was one like a son of man, with a crown of gold on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. Then another angel came out of the temple and called in a loud voice to him who was sitting on the cloud, "Take your sickle and reap, because the time to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is ripe." So he who was seated on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was harvested. Another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. Still another angel, who had charge of the fire, came from the altar and called in a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, "Take your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of grapes from the earth's vine, because its grapes are ripe." The angel swung his sickle on the earth, gathered its grapes, and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. They were trampled in the winepress outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press, rising as high as the horses' bridles for a distance of 1,600 stadia.
Okay. Revelation 13 was a description of the final battle from the dragon's side. Revelation 14 is a description of the final conflict from the side of God and his people. Chapter 14 is the response of God's people to the actions of the counterfeit Trinity. So we've already seen quite the diabolical conspiracy starting to take shape against God and his people. Now we're going to look at who God's end time people are going to be and what they're going to be like. Then we're going to look at their actions in the context of the final conflict. So, first of all, who are God's end time people? As usual, there's a number of different theories of who make up God's end time people described in Revelation 12:17. The remnant, they're often called. Who are these remnant people? The word remnant is used in the King James Version of the Bible. The dictionary definition of the original word, the Greek word loipos, or the rest, or the remaining ones, the ones that are left behind. So, who are the rest, the remaining ones, the remnant in Revelation? Is it the churches of John's day? Well, the preterist school of interpretation, we talked about that the first day, they would say so. And certainly they must have felt themselves to be God's remnant people. What Christian doesn't consider himself to be a part of God's remnant people? Hopefully we all do. But is that the ultimate meaning of the text? So let's explore it. Some say that God's people means a specific church or denomination. Others say that God's remnant people are Christians of all ages. And others say God's remnant people are an unknown end-time entity that doesn't exist yet. So which of these theories, if any, is correct? Who are God's last day people identified in Revelation 14 who are going to be a part of this final conflict responding to the deception of the counterfeit Trinity? So let's go to the text, see what clues are given outright. Remember, we're still working in the context of Revelation 12:17, which places us in the time of the final context, the time of the end. In that verse, Revelation 12:17, we've already read a couple of major clues that identify the remnant. Remember them? The dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring, those who obey God's commandments and have the testimony of Jesus. The woman's children keep the commandments and have the testimony of Jesus. So those are probably two of the most important identifying characteristics of God's last day remnant people. So let's start here with several identifying marks of God's last day people. The first mark is that they keep the commandments. And you all know what those are, the Ten Commandments. Back at Mount Sinai, God with his own finger burned two tablets of stone, gave them to Moses. It's the only part of the Bible that God wrote with his own finger in his own words. Pretty important stuff, wouldn't you say? So, and by the way, the Ten Commandments were not new to Israel. When he gave them to them at Sinai, the investigation of the Old Testament will quickly reveal that those laws had been in effect since the fall of man at the Garden of Eden. They knew about them, but they had never been written down, codified. So since God was creating for himself a nation, he gave them some laws. He gave them the Ten Commandments in writing. Now, given the fact that keeping the commandments is emphasized in Revelation, would common sense say that God's end-time people would keep some of the commandments or all of them? Logic. Be all of them, right? I mean, you can walk into any prison and say, who here has not murdered someone? And a lot of people would raise their hand, right? They have, in effect, kept some of the commandments. So it doesn't even make sense that it would just mean they keep some of the commandments. So would it make sense that God's remnant church would be identified by the fact that they keep a few? That's ludicrous. It would make sense that one of the identifying marks of God's remnant people is a desire and an effort to be faithful to all of the commandments. So there's mark number one. God's end-time remnant people keep all of the commandments. Mark number two, they have the testimony of Jesus. What is that? What is the testimony of Jesus? Fortunately, we don't have to guess. John tells us outright. Do not do it. What John done was that an angel came and was talking to him, and he fell down in worship before the angel. And the angel said, do not do it. I am a fellow servant with you and with your brothers who hold the testimony of Jesus. There's the phrase we're looking for, right? Worship God. For the testimony of Jesus is, drumroll, the spirit of prophecy. Okay? So we know what the testimony of Jesus is. It is the spirit of prophecy. So John and his brothers have the testimony of Jesus, which is the spirit of prophecy. The angel further expands on this in Revelation 22:9. Again, John does the same thing. He doesn't learn real fast. He falls down in front of the angel to worship, and the angel says, no, don't do not do it. I am a fellow servant with you and your brothers, the prophets. He adds that, the prophets. And all who keep the words of this book worship God. So John's brothers are the prophets, and the thing that John and his brothers, the prophets, had in common was the testimony of Jesus or the spirit of prophecy. So the gift of prophecy is what they had in common. They were prophets. So the first two marks of God's end-time remnant people is that they try to be obedient to all of God's commandments, and they have the gift of prophecy among them. Have you ever heard the idea that after the cross, God would send no more prophets? Have you ever heard that? Given this description of God's last day people, what does that tell us about that theory? It's not even possible. Clearly, the gift of prophecy is going to be alive and well all the way to the end of time, which means that we must accept the potential, at least, for modern-day prophets, because one of the marks of God's last-day people is they're going to have the gift of prophecy among them. It's one of the requirements there, because that's one of the identifying characteristics. So before involving yourself too deeply with any group, ask two foundational questions. Are they keeping all the commandments, and do they at least acknowledge the potential for modern-day prophets to be among them? At least that. Of course, we do have to be careful with this, right? There are plenty of people who take the gift of prophecy to extremes. We've seen that, right? So we want to avoid that. And there are also, where there are true prophets, there are false prophets. For false Christs and false prophets will appear. So we have to accept the potential of a modern-day prophet, but we also have to be very careful who we accept as a modern-day prophet. There's a lot to choose from out there, and none that I'm familiar with at the moment that I would be following, at least not living. Jesus already told us, though, that we're going to have to discern between the true and the false. That's why we have the biblical tests of the prophets, right? This is something that I actually appreciate about our church, because we take this seriously. And so whenever a letter goes to the headquarters of our church saying, I am a prophet of God, you know, my first reaction would be, toss it in the trash, right? They don't. They say, well, okay, let's run it through the test of the prophets. Because if there's a true prophet, we don't want to miss it. That's status quo for prophets. People, they come and everybody rejects them until they're dead, right? Isn't that the way it worked in the Old Testament? And so, well, the truth is it doesn't take very long running them through the test of the prophets, then you can go ahead and throw the letter in the trash, which is what happens. But we have to at least acknowledge the possibility, because God has said that the gift of prophecy will continue to the time of the end. So to my knowledge, for the last nearly 100 years, everyone claiming this gift has turned out to be a false prophet. So with just those two characteristics, a lot of Christians, they might be able to feel good about their identity, their ideas concerning the identity of the remnant of Revelation. The churches of John's day certainly met those two criteria. So at this point, anyway, they would still be God's remnant church for their time. God has always had a remnant church, a remnant people. So there is no remnant people before the end time remnant. So as far as that goes, they're still in good shape. However, this part of Revelation is concerned with the last days of Earth's history. Is it possible that the churches of John's day could be a last day remnant? That's impossible, of course, since they weren't living during the time of the end. So, but God has always had a called and chosen people. So the churches of John's day would definitely have comprised the remnant church at that time. But there seems to be a deeper meaning to the remnant church in this part of Revelation, that the churches of John's day would not have been able to fulfill simply because they weren't living during the time of the end. At the time, though, Christians kept all the commandments, including the fourth, the Sabbath commandment. That didn't change until, 300 years after Christ or so. They also had John among them with the gift of prophecy. So they were God's remnant church leading up to the time of the end, but they can't be the group that's in view in this part of Revelation. Neither can it be all Christians throughout all history, because the group in view, not all Christians can honestly claim to keep all the commandments or that they have the gift of prophecy among them. So back to our list of possibilities. God's end-time remnant can't be all Christians in general, and they can't be the seven churches of John's day. There are more identifying characteristics of remnant that narrow the field even further, though. Mark, number 3. In Revelation 16:14, the dragon gathers the forces of the entire world against this remnant, which means that the remnant described here are the object of worldwide attention by the leading powers. Now, what does that mean? How can a small group of people capture the attention of all the world's leaders? Well, it's not impossible because terrorists have managed to do it, haven't they? Here's a small group of people that have captured the attention of the world's leaders so significantly that the world cooperates together, spending billions and billions of dollars to fight them. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that terrorists are God's end-time people. That's not the point. But a small minority can capture the attention of the world powers. It's possible to do. From the text, we can see that this will be the situation of God's remnant people at the time of the end. They're going to hold the attention of the world's leaders. So there's another strong characteristic that not many can claim. What group of people is so well known that it holds the attention of the world's leaders, keeps all the commandments, and claims to have the gift of prophecy among them? None that I can think of. Not now, anyway. So at this point, all we're left with is the option that this part of Revelation, that we're seeing an end-time group that doesn't yet exist in its final form. The group that will become the end-time remnant exists even now because God has always had that group. But the end-time remnant is still in the process of being developed. And some of those developments are not going to be able to take place until the very end. Won't even be possible until the very end. Which brings us to Mark number 4. Another characteristic of God's end-time people shows up in Revelation 13, 15 to 17. The dragon makes it impossible for this group to buy and sell. It places economic sanctions against them. Mark number 5, Revelation 17, 14, we see that this end-time remnant is also the focus of a worldwide coalition because the nations of the earth together are going to go after God's faithful people. And we're going to see when we get to Revelation 17 how the powers of earth are going to unite with the common purpose of destroying this group of people. Here's just a preview. They will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and with him will be his called chosen and faithful followers. Okay, they're going to make war against the Lamb. Mark number 6, Revelation 14, 7, the message of the first of the three angels. We see that this group has a special message that goes to every nation, tribe, language, and people, which means that their message is significant to the entire world. Okay, this group is carrying a message that is significant to the entire world. No one carries a message right now that is significant to everyone. We Christians, we know that the gospel message that we carry ought to be significant to everyone in the world. But when we consider, for example, the 1040 window, have you ever seen this map before? The 1040 window area of the world, across Asia, mostly, two-thirds of the world's population lives in this square, right across there, okay? Two-thirds of the world's population. Christians make up 1%. 1%. The people in this region do not consider our message to be significant. Otherwise, they'd be listening. The impression I get when I put all this information together is that the remnant described in Revelation is something different than what now exists in its current form. So here's a definition of the remnant of Revelation proposed by Dr. John Pauline, who, as far as I'm concerned, is one of Christianity's foremost scholars in the book of Revelation. The remnant of Revelation would seem to be a worldwide spiritual last day group drawn from every worldwide organization and government. That's the conclusion he came to for the last day remnant. God's end time remnant church is worldwide and it's spiritual, meaning that the people are marked more by their character and their message than they are by their affiliation with any particular organization. The end-time remnant of Revelation is a group of people made of every nation, every language, every ethnic group who come together on the basis of God's special proclamation of the gospel during the very last days of Earth's history. However, there must be someone that makes this happen, right? Since God has always had a chosen people, it's obvious that it's from this group that God has always had that this end-time remnant is going to come. So even though you and I may not fit all of the characteristics of God's end-time remnant, they do already exist, and they have seized hold of the message of Revelation. They've put that package together, and they're helping to bring on this last-day remnant that we see described here. That makes sense, right? Somebody's got to start it. So they can't yet be God's remnant people in its last-day form, but they're heading in that direction. And what they're going to do is they're going to be calling people to recognize the time in which we live, to get into the Scriptures, especially the prophecies, to enter into a saving relationship with Jesus Christ, to obey all the commandments, and so on. So there's not very many people pointing in that pretty narrow direction. There are not many people attempting to keep all the commandments. There aren't many people at least admit the possibility of the gift of prophecy could be among them, and so on. In the context of what we're seeing in our study, these are vital questions that every one of us need to ask if we want to be a part of this movement that brings on God's last day remnant people. So if we can't find someone like that around us, then let me ask you this. Why not become the beginning of that movement ourselves? Amen? I mean, why not move in that direction? That's why I said that prophecy is not so much intended to fill in every detail about the future, but it's to give us enough information that's going to help us prioritize our lives for today. This stuff should make a difference in our lives beginning immediately. So let's get together. Let's bring on this final movement that we're seeing in Revelation. Okay, let's run through the study guide real quick. This was a shorter one, and we'll just go right on into the next one. Number one of section 9 on your study guide. Revelation is a description of the final conflict from the side of God and his people. Number two, the marks of God's end-time remnant people include, Mark 1, they keep all the commandments. Mark 2, they have the testimony of Jesus, which is the gift of prophecy. Mark 3, they are the object of worldwide attention. Mark 4, they are the object of economic sanctions. Mark 5, they are the object of a worldwide coalition. And Mark 6, they carry a message significant to the entire world. Number 3, the remnant of Revelation would seem to be a worldwide spiritual last day. Worldwide spiritual last day group drawn from every worldwide organization and government. The remnant of Revelation seems to be marked by its character and its message more than by their affiliation by any particular organization. Character and message. The sense that we get, number 5, the sense that we get is that the last day remnant of Revelation does not yet exist in its final form, which would make sense. There's not even a death decree out there yet, so can't be. Number 6, someone must start this movement. And if there's no one around us doing this, we should begin it ourselves. Okay. In these last days, those who are trying to identify God's remnant church are going to need to be looking less for a people who are part of a particular organization and more for their character and their message. It's not that this particular group is not organized. Historically, the remnant has always been organized as a group. However, during the last days, and that's where we're located here, during the last days, it appears that things are going to be pretty messy. And we're going to see that more as we get into the Battle of Armageddon. So if you're trying to decide, if you're living in the last days, you're trying to decide who's on God's side and not, you're going to want to pay more attention to the people's character and their message than what organization they're going to be a part of. So let's look specifically at what Revelation says about the character of the remnant. Then I looked, and there before me was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. Who are the 144,000? Are they the same group as the remnant? Are they kind of a subcategory of the remnant? Are they an entirely separate group? Once again, allusion to the rescue. The answer is pretty clear when you take into account Joel 2:32. And I can tell this is a pretty commonly accepted allusion because your general cross-references list it. Here it is, Joel 2:32. And everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. For on Mount Zion, in Jerusalem, there will be deliverance, as the Lord has said among the survivors, that's the same word, loipos, remnant, whom the Lord calls. So the prophet Joel is describing a remnant from Jerusalem, called survivors in this translation. They call in the name of the Lord. They stand on Mount Zion. So there isn't any question that Revelation is recalling this scene. Scholars recognize it across the board. John sees the remnant standing on Mount Zion, And in relation to the Father's name, which is written on their foreheads, and it's also called the seal of God in Revelation, but Revelation makes a change. Instead of calling them those that remain, or the remnant, he calls them the 144,000. So considering that the last place we saw God's last day people in Revelation was in chapter 12, verse 17, Revelation seems to be telling us that this is not two different groups, they're the same group. And I think if you study Revelation 7 carefully, you'll find out the great multitude that could not be numbered is also the same group. That's at least three different ways of describing the end-time remnant of Revelation, which is typical for Revelation. It uses different symbols for the same thing. Now, if in fact the 144,000 and the great multitude that cannot be numbered are the same group, what does that tell you about the number 144,000? Is it a literal number or is it a symbolic number? It has to be symbolic. So this group is known by different names in Revelation. Names are usually significant in Scripture. And each of these names for the remnant gives us different clues about the character of these people. They have the name of the Lamb and His Father's name written on their foreheads. In Old Testament times, the marking on the forehead was a recognition of that person's character. So in John's thinking, having the names of the Lamb and the Father on their foreheads means that they reflect the character of God, right? They reflect Jesus' character. Well, what does that look like? Well, our character is revealed in our actions, correct? Just like Jesus' character was revealed in His actions. So the things that we do should reveal the same underlying character that motivated Jesus' actions. Jesus' actions backed up His words. So if Jesus, or us as Christians, said, you know, we really shouldn't complain, and we go complain. We really shouldn't gossip. Have you heard about such and such? We really shouldn't, you know, this and that, and then we go do it. I mean, what does that say about our character? Jesus' actions backed up His words. He walked His talk. I mean, the truth is, if you take Jesus at His words alone, He comes off to many looking the part of a sissy. I'm serious. Be nice to people. If he slaps you, don't fight back, right? Don't worry about providing for your family. Look at the birds and the flowers. They don't work. Love your enemies, and so on, okay? We wonder why men don't show up in church as often as women do, at least in our Western culture. I submit to you, this may be, well, one of the reasons. If that's what Jesus thinks a man should be, then give me tackle football and hunting and wrestling and so on, right? This all comes from a devil-inspired misunderstanding of the character of Jesus. Jesus was anything but a spineless wimp. He was strong enough to go 40 days without food. How many of you can do that? He was strong enough to spend entire nights in prayer. How many of you have done that? He was strong enough not to hit back. That's something that takes a lot more strength than fighting. Jesus was strong enough to resist everything the devil threw at Him at Gethsemane. And He was strong enough to take brutal lashings and was still be able to give a good effort to carrying His own cross. Jesus was tough. Jesus also had authority. A few words from Him, and the temple emptied. A few words from Him, His enemies were silenced. Jesus was fearless. He was fearless enough to stand firm as crazed men rushed Him. Remember what His disciples, tough Peter, James, and John, sons of thunder, you remember what they did, right? They exited the scene quickly. Not Jesus. He was fearless enough to sleep through a life-threatening storm. No concern. He slept. He was fearless enough to say, not my will, but yours be done to His Father. Tell me that didn't take guts. Jesus was courageous. Courageous enough to stand alone more often than not. Courageous enough to go against the popular way. I mean, the religious leaders were all against Him. You can't do this on the Sabbath day. You can't do that. You know, and Jesus says, that's not the way it's supposed to be. He stood alone against the popular way. He was courageous enough to not fight back. Courageous enough to stand firm before the Roman whip. Courageous enough to take it in silence as nails were pounded through His hands and feet. He was courageous enough to forgive and to die for the people who hated Him. And on and on and on. That's the kind of character Jesus modeled as a true man. And that's the kind of character that his people are going to strive to have. Fearlessly upholding truth, courageously standing in the minority if necessary. I have a challenge, an outstanding challenge to people, to find me some place in the Bible where the majority was right. They never are. It's always the outcasts, those that are being laughed at and scoffed at, even by the religious leaders, that it turned out to be right. Courageously standing in the minority if necessary, authoritatively preaching what God is really all about, strongly resisting the urge to fight using the devil's tactics. For goodness sake, do not believe the lie that the devil has sold us to this whole planet about what it means to be true men and women. Jesus is the one who designed and created us, and he's the one that showed us what it's really all about. So God's remnant people reflect the character of Jesus. The next characteristic is found in Revelation 14:4. These are those who did not defile themselves with women, for they kept themselves pure. They follow the Lamb wherever he goes. Is Revelation literal or symbolic? It's symbolic. They kept themselves pure. This is sexual imagery, which is common Old Testament language concerning what? Anybody know? Loyalty. Right? Loyalty to God. When Old Testament Israel started to serve other gods, the prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and so on, they showed up preaching using the language of adultery, prostitution, and sexual unfaithfulness to describe the equivalent of what Israel was doing to God in their spiritual unfaithfulness, right? It's all over. You can't hardly read, much less preach from the Old Testament prophets with children in the room. For those acquainted with Old Testament imagery and language, this idea of not being defiled by women here is clearly not a commentary on the sexuality of God's people or women. It's a commentary on loyalty to God. So Revelation 14:4 again. These are those who did not defile themselves with women, for they kept themselves pure. They follow the Lamb wherever he goes. In other words, they are in continuous relationship with Jesus. And this is much, much more than point to the date and the time when they were saved. And that's the end of it. It's much more than just once a week at 11 o'clock, Saturday or Sunday morning relationship. It's a continual, constant, unceasing relationship with Jesus, which marks the character of God's remnant and time remnant people. I just mentioned this as a sermon the other day. I was listening on the radio, Voice of Prophecy, I think it was. They said, did you know that a devotional life is not biblical? You know, my ears perked up. What? A devotional life is not biblical? And they said, no, that makes it sound like you have a time in the morning for God, and that's good. He said, what's really biblical is a life of devotion. You know, it's all, you're always on. Not just a little short time in the morning. Continuous relationship with Jesus. They're serious about their relationship. They intentionally work on that relationship, just as people with strong marriages work on their relationship. God's people spend time in his word to us. They spend time in prayer. They spend time alone with God. They discipline themselves physically and mentally because they understand the effect that has on them spiritually. They're disciples of Jesus, growing daily in him. Next one. They were purchased from among men and offered as first fruits to God and the Lamb. No lie was found in their mouths. They are blameless. What does that mean? Does that mean if you've ever told a fib, you're sunk? Remember the letter back to Laodicea back in Revelation 3. Have you read that one before? The letter to Laodicea in Revelation 3. The church of Laodicea is lying. They say that they're rich and need of nothing, but the truth is that they are pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. Right? They're lying. Now, as odd as it may seem, and does seem odd, Bible scholars recognize that Laodicea and the 144,000 are the same group. How can that be? How do you put those two together? The remnant with the character of Jesus and the Laodiceans who are lukewarm and pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. The connection is possible, even though they're part of Laodicea, because the remnant are authentic about their true condition. We take a tremendous step toward becoming a part of God's remnant people when we are willing to frankly admit the truth about ourselves, that we are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. When we admit that we are messed up people and that we need Jesus Christ for everything, we're telling the truth. There's no lie found in our mouths that claims to have some sort of a righteousness before God. The message of the gospel has two sides. The first message is that we are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. In short, we're lost. The second message is that in spite of our condition, we are acceptable to God in Jesus Christ. That's the message of the cross. At Jesus' death on the cross, God condemned the sinful condition of the human race. And then at the resurrection of Jesus, God accepted the human race in Jesus because he was now our representative. The beauty of the gospel is that the more hurt we are by our own condition, the more clearly we understand that in Jesus Christ we are acceptable to God. Amen? So God's last day people are going to be authentic about their condition. They admit their serious brokenness, but they will strive to walk closer and closer to Jesus in the knowledge that in him we can be saved anyway. They were purchased from among men and offered as first fruits to God and the Lamb. No lie was found in their mouths. They are blameless, not sinless, blameless. And that's different. In other words, they have become like Jesus. This doesn't mean they're perfect, doesn't mean they don't struggle with sin and temptation, but it does mean that they are completely loyal to God. When we are truly loyal, we are blameless even when we make mistakes. Making mistakes is not the same as disobedience. You understand that, right? Making mistakes is not the same thing as disobedience. My children are not perfect, but as long as they are doing their best, as long as they are consistently maturing into the well-rounded adults I hope they'll someday become, they are blameless. As long as they're on the right path. Blamelessness is consistent with spiritual growth and maturity. We are blameless as long as we are consistently progressing in that direction, right? My children are blameless in my eyes as long as they're heading in the right direction. Turn around and go the opposite direction, things change. But they're blameless as long as they're heading in the right direction because I know they're growing and I'm going to help them grow. Same way. The good news, and this is good news, the good news is that you can be blameless right now. You like that? You can be blameless right now by making the decision to be loyal to Jesus no matter what. Somebody just at this table said it doesn't matter what the truth is as long as it's the truth. Right? Doesn't matter what it is as long as it is. So would you like to be blameless right now? Sure you would. So I'll invite you. Simply surrender your life to Jesus. Even if it's for the thousandth time. Paul says, I die daily, right? Give Jesus permission to come into your life and transform you. You don't have to understand completely how he does it, but simply give him permission to do what you may not understand. If you sincerely do that right now, you're heading in the right direction. You're blameless before God. The gospel really is true good news, isn't it? It's good news. Okay, what are God's remnant people going to be saying? What will be their message? Revelation 14 spells it out. Verse 6. Then I saw another angel flying in midair, and he had the eternal gospel to proclaim to those who live on the earth, to every nation, tribe, languages, and people. Language and people. These are the three angels' messages. We've already seen from earlier that the three angels represent evangelism. You remember that? The Greek word is evangelizon, so it's clear, God's people carrying the message to the world. So that's our context here. As this final message is going out, it's going to be a message grounded in the gospel. We know that already too. No matter what the remnant talk about, be it Revelation, Daniel, sanctuary, whatever, it's always grounded in the gospel. The story of how Jesus came to earth, lived his life as an example for us, overcame sin, suffered for our sins, and died on the cross to save us again, all in order to overcome evil and save us. The message of the remnant is always grounded in the good news. All paths lead to the good news as it is in Jesus. Always. And that proclamation of the gospel will go to the entire world. same as Revelation 10:11 says. But we're talking about the time of the end here. So even though the gospel has been proclaimed since the time of Jesus, the message of the remnant is going to have particular significance for the time of the end. So what will that gospel message include? The heart of the final message then is in the next verse. He said in a loud voice, "Fear God, give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and the springs of water." So what is the fundamental message? The three major commands: fear, give, worship. The gospel message of the remnant that they are carrying to the world is to fear God, give him glory, and worship him. So why does the verse say that we should fear God, give him glory, and worship him? Why? Because the hour of his judgment has come. Has come already. Remember Revelation 13? The tenses were very important because they told us the time frame in which we were looking. Here it's the same thing. The hour of God's judgment has come. It will begin before the end. We see that important detail in the original language. We usually think of judgment at the second coming, and that's true. But there's much more to judgment than happens at the second coming. Just like there's more judgment in county court than the judge simply dropping his gavel. There's more to it than that. We all know that there's a process to judgment, more to it than just sentencing. And what's even more interesting to me is that this judgment begins even while the proclamation of the gospel is still going to the world. The time of his judgment has come during the proclamation of the gospel. Now, this is not the sentencing phase of judgment that we're talking about. That does come at the second coming. This, you might say, is the investigative phase of judgment. Think of it this way. For a prisoner, one part of judgment has already been done. He went to prison for his crime, right? However, eventually he's freed, but not entirely. He's put on probation for a time. Judgment has forgiven his crime, but in a way, judgment has arrived again for him. He's going to be watched. He's going to be evaluated during this time to see if he will be allowed to go entirely free. The judge is asking the question, has there been a change of heart in this criminal? That's what the judge wants to know, right? That's what probation is about. The verdict is still in the future while he's on parole, but judgment time has already arrived. That's what the time of the end is all about. It is preparation for sentencing. And this is what we're seeing here in this text and throughout Scripture. Judgment has arrived for us. We are pardoned sinners, thanks to Jesus' death on the cross for us. We are pardoned. However, we are still facing judgment, in which the question is, has there been a change of heart? Are our actions proving that there has been a change of heart? I know that this isn't a message you hear typically, I realize that, but if what I'm seeing here in Revelation is right, this part of the message is going to gain prominence the closer we get to the time of the end, or the second coming. It's what makes the end time message so urgent. Judgment has already begun. Sit up, take note. The court in heaven has been seated. Probation is open. However, in Revelation 14:7, the message is to fear God, give him glory, and worship him. The judgment part is primarily, it's a time location. Where are we in this process of judgment? There are three different times of judgment in the Bible, and this reference to judgment shows us that we're dealing with the judgment at the end. First judgment is at the cross. In the person of Jesus Christ, the entire human race was judged at the cross, negatively judged at the cross, and then judged positively at the resurrection. In Jesus Christ, God rejected us at the cross, then in Jesus Christ, he accepted us in Jesus Christ at the resurrection. So that was a judgment situation. So judgment on the human race happened at the cross. The next time that judgment happens is every time that the cross is preached. Every time the cross of Jesus Christ is preached, it is a time of judgment for those who hear the message. Because when we hear the cross of Christ preached, we have to make a choice. We can't be neutral on it. We can't ignore the sermon. You either agree or you disagree. You accept or you reject it. You have to either say, yes, Jesus died for me and I choose to accept that gift from him, or I have to say, no, I'd rather not admit how rotten I actually am. I'd rather keep it a secret. I'd rather walk away from here. Every time that we talk about the cross of Christ, people have to be drawn either closer to Christ or be driven a little bit farther away. So that's a time of judgment. Finally, there's judgment at the end in relation to the second coming. So really, when you think about it, we pass judgment on ourselves by accepting or rejecting Christ during the course of our lives every time we consider the cross of Christ. The final judgment, all the final judgment does is ratify our own decision. The judge says, well, you know, I don't like your decision, but it is yours to make. And the gavel falls, our fate is sealed. Now, near the beginning, in Revelation 6:10, the saints call out the question, how long will you not be judging? Near the end, though, Revelation 19, which is still before the second coming, judgment is finished and done. At that point, it's done. The message of judgment is a call to be accountable before God right now. That's it. To be accountable to God right now. Like the illustration of the prisoner who's on parole, he's being evaluated. Judgment time is here. It's not over. It's currently going on. This gives 1 Corinthians 6:2 some teeth when Paul says, now is the day of God's favor. Now is the day of salvation. Just like parole is a call to special accountability before the judge. This investigative phase of judgment is a call to special accountability to God. That's the time we're living in now. Special accountability to God. But if what I see around me is any indication, people don't like accountability. But accountability is everything. Very little good is accomplished without accountability. You know that? A good illustration I heard was as you decide to, you need to do a little more exercise, you need to go jogging, and so you make a deal with a friend, I'm going to meet you out in the corner 6 o'clock, and we're going to jog. Well, come 5:30, that didn't sound like such a good idea anymore. You know, bed is warm and cozy. And you're just going to snuggle back down in there, and then, oh yeah, I promised my friend that I would meet them there. And so you drag yourself out and get out of bed, and you go out to the corner and go jogging. What you don't realize is that your friend wanted to stay in bed too, and the only reason he was there is because you were. Right? That's accountability. It's a good thing. There's something else about accountability. It also provides meaning for the ordinary duties of life. Jesus said that if you give a cup of cold water to a child, it will be remembered in the day of judgment. How insignificant is that? And it's going to be remembered in the day of judgment. What a great text. I love this text. Every little action. Chipping ice off the sidewalk. Caring for a child in the middle of the night, cooking a meal for your family, or a group of people coming to a prophecy meeting. Every little thing that we do matters, and it will be remembered by God at judgment. Does it make you think about the things that you do and don't do? Judgment remembers it all. Nothing you do, good or bad, nothing you do is unimportant. Everything matters, no matter how small. It's going to come up at the parole hearing. Judgment. If we live our lives faithfully to God, this kind of judgment is awesome news. Isn't it? If we live faithfully to God, it is awesome news. Just like it is for the prisoner on parole who has had a change of heart. For the faithful, judgment is something to look forward to. Not dread. We also know that at judgment, God is going to set everything right again. Judgment is the time of fixing everything that was broken during the reign of sin on planet Earth. We are powerless to set things right ourselves. We can't change what happened in Rwanda. We can't undo past child abuse. We can't fix anything that has been broken. We can't fix unjust accusations. We can't fix any of it. The injustices of life, rape, torture, murder, everything. But in the judgment, God's going to set it all right. If you've been the victim of wrongs, God's going to make it right. Now, we may not see how God can do that. I mean, it feels like for some things there is no possibility, short of a miracle, of how anything could set right what happened to us. But ladies and gentlemen, we serve a God of miracles, don't we? Nothing is impossible for Him. He has never, ever failed. And if He says He's going to set things right, He's going to set things right. You can count on it. You can be sure of it. People are afraid of judgment, but the fact is, next to the gospel itself, judgment is the best news out there that we can bring to people. God is going to set everything right that has happened wrong on planet Earth. Every one of you here tonight can think of ways that you have been wronged. Maybe you've been abused. Maybe you were robbed. Maybe you were taken advantage of in some way. I don't know how you've been wronged, but every one of us has been. God will not overlook anything. At judgment, He's going to set it right. That's good news. It's good news. The only ones that need to fear judgment are those who have chosen not to accept the covering righteousness of Jesus Christ. Those who are unfaithful to what they know to be right. Those who are not loyal to the Lamb of Revelation. Those are the only ones that need to fear judgment. But understand this. The analogy of the prisoner on parole left out one crucial element. Very crucial element. For those who have had a change of heart and have accepted Jesus' sacrifice in our place, in this investigative stage of judgment, the judge is not looking at your performance at all. He's looking at Jesus Christ's performance. All you have to do is accept Him in your place. Yes, I want Him to be my representative. Now, if that doesn't make the gospel good news, I can't imagine what would. Would it? If we will allow Jesus to be our righteousness by accepting the gift that He gave us on the cross, we have nothing to fear from judgment. Indeed, we look forward to judgment, the day that God is going to set all the injustices right again. You don't have to do revenge. God says vengeance is mine, and He's going to do vengeance right. That's judgment, and that is good news for God's people. So judgment is why God's last day people are preaching the message of the three angels in Revelation 14. Let's run through the study guide. The remnant, the 144,000, and the great multitude that cannot be numbered are different names for the same group of people. Number two, the remnant of Revelation will reflect the character of Jesus, including strength, authority, fearlessness, and courage. Character. Number three, kept themselves pure refers to loyalty to God. Number four, following the Lamb wherever He goes refers to a continuous relationship with Jesus. And it would refer to more than that too. That's just one of the things. Number five, no lie was found in their mouths refers to the fact that God's people will be authentic about their true condition. Number six, the double message of the cross is that because of our condition we are lost, but in spite of that we are acceptable to God in Jesus. Number seven, they are blameless refers to the fact that God's people have become like Jesus. Number eight, we can be blameless right now simply by giving Jesus permission to begin His work of transforming our lives. Number nine, the three angels' messages represent the gospel going to the world. Number ten, the final message of God's last day people will be grounded in the gospel. The three major commands of Revelation 14:7 are fear, give, and worship. Number 12, we should pay attention to these commands because judgment has already begun during the time of the final proclamation of the gospel. Proclamation. The three times of judgment are at the cross, each time the cross is preached, and judgment at the end. Number 14, this pre-Advent judgment is a call to be particularly accountable to God, even in the little things of life. Number 15, judgment will set wrongs right again.
Thank you for joining Pastor Jeff Scoggins today for Worship in Spirit and Truth. We would love to hear your thoughts about the program, and your financial support is also greatly appreciated so that we can continue bringing you these kinds of programs. Tell your friends they can find the program Spirit and Truth right here on this station. Stay tuned for contact information and more details from your local station to follow. Until next time, keep your mind fixed on Jesus.